Good evening. This is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them. With me, your host, Seth Titley Jones. Just like it is every week. And this week, we have got the Beatles. This is the first song we start with in Toby Creswell's book of 1001 songs, which he says are the songs that he reckons, in his wealth of journalistic experience, are the most influential songs over the past sort of 100 years. And his... and the first one we're going to look at this week is The Beatles and I, Me, Mine, the last song recorded on the final Beatles recording session, although John Lennon wasn't there, is George Harrison's critique of Ego, an Austrian marching band he saw on television inspired the melody. The words were inspired by his interest in Indian mysticism, as the Beatles were in turmoil about each other's egos and battles over money. It's likely that this implicated on the lyric as well. The song, as finished in the studio, was only a 90-second riff that Phil Spector edited into a double that length. The tune's saving grace is that melancholic guitar line from Harrison in the chorus, which work against the pushy, testy mood of the verses. The quiet Beatle, it appears, had the perspective on what was tearing apart the Fab Four. And this is The Beatles and I, Me, Mine. Have a listen to it. See if you think it sounds like an Austrian marching band. When I find the track...
I'm in the day, mine, I'm in mine, I'm in mine. All through the night, I'm in mine, I'm in mine, I'm in mine. Now the frightened are leaving it, everyone's weaving it, coming on strong all the time. All through the day, I'm in mine.
The Beatles and I, Me, Mine here on Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4 FM. This is 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, selected by Toby Creswell and presented by me, your host, Seth Titley Jones. Moving right along here, we have Carole King and I Feel the Earth Move from 1971. In the late 50s, while studying to become a teacher, Carole Klein was drawn into the Brill Building scene where she met her future husband, Jerry Goffin. Goffin King were a hit-making machine from the Bobby Soxing 50s though, to the hippie era of the mid-60s, Will You Love Me Tomorrow, The Locomotion, Up on the Roof, Chains, I'm Into Something Good, Don't Bring Me Down, Wasn't Born to Follow, this list goes on for a while, Pleasant Valley Sunday, and You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman. The hits kept coming until the couple divorced in 1967. It was the feminist fairy tale when the newly unshackled king recorded her own songs. Recorded in 1970, Tapestry was the female equivalent of her friend James Taylor's Sweet Baby James. It was like the calming coda to the turbulent 1960s. The cover photo says it all. Hair long and natural, blue jeans, casual shirt, bare feet, and a tabby cat. Here was a genuinely natural woman from the post-Woodstock era, casual, sexy, and real. King reworked two of her brill-building hits, Will You Love Me Tomorrow and You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, which laid a bridge between the songcraft of the pre-Beatles era and the cynical Nixon years. Her mellifluous piano matched her singing voice, which was sensual and mature. I Feel the Earth Move is a mature version of the breathless love songs of her youth, powered by a very funky band and King's joyous vocal. The song was perfect for the liberated woman. Her first solo album shifted 5,000 copies. Tapestry, her third, moved over to 10 million, making it the largest selling album by a female artist until Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill. King also spearheaded a movement towards the confessional singer-songwriter that was to dominate rock and roll for decades. King once said, "Until I met Jerry, I was just a musician who wrote bad lyrics." Tapestry proved otherwise. Carole King and I Feel the Earth Move. King and I Feel the Earth Move here on Waiheke Radio. Underworld. and Born Slippy from 1995. The hook line, Lager, 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 ensured Underworld's breakthrough techno hit would reach the world beyond Clubland to the furthest regions of the suburbs and the heights of the football terraces. The song's appearance in Danny Boyle's film Trainspotting put it right over the edge. An overdose of drugs and adrenaline, the song is a relentless, intoxicating electronic track of keyboards and drum machine driven by a rhythmic vocal chant. Trainspotting was a key moment in the 90s, an underground film full of moral complexity and great music. It had a definite 90s atmosphere. The 80s were like ancient history. Underworld had gone through the same transformation. They were an 80s pop rock band with one small hit underneath the radar. Then singer Carl Hyde and his longtime collaborator Rick Smith enlisted DJ Darren Emerson and refashioned their sound. Born Slippy, which takes its name from a greyhound, was a song that Hyde wrote about his personal battle with alcoholism. It was all about the horrors I'd experienced whilst being over-medicated on alcohol for a lot of the years, he said. And I kind of thought, if I just write out this autobiographical piece that's horrific, you know, people will go, oh my God, Jesus, what's that all about? That's horrible. What's that about? Now I'd be able to say, that one's about me. How's about a bit of help? No, we came out and explained it, and then Danny did what he did with the film, and then I think the whole balance was redressed, and it's fine. People want to use it as a drinking anthem, and I don't really have any problem with that now. This is Underworld and Born Slippy.
Lager, 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 lager
Underworld, Born Slippy, here on Waiheke Radio, 88.3, 107.4 FM. You're listening to 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them. Don't forget, here at Waiheke Radio, if you don't happen to be within the range that our transmission aerials cover, you can always tune into us online at www.waihikiradio.org.nz, where we have live streaming of this very show, and you can get all the shows on demand there. Or, well, most of them. You can certainly get my show on demand there, but why would you want to if you're listening to it right now? Unless you do happen to be listening to it on demand. In which case, well, good on you. Anyway, wherever and whenever you're listening to this show, the next track is by Hot Tuna, and it's called Keep Your Lamps Trimmed and Burning. When life in the Jefferson Airplane got too weird, guitarist Jorma Kaukonen, and I'm not quite sure where he's from or how to say his name, but, well, if anyone has any ideas, and bass player Jack Cassidy, oh, that's easier, started a side project playing ragtime blues. Their first album, recorded live with only the addition of a harp player, Will Scarlett, was a low-key gem, mostly of old-time blues. As the Airplane further splintered, Hot Tuna kept getting better. By their second album, they had added 50-something fiddle player Papa John Kreisch and drummer Sammy Piazza, and they were overtaking the Airplane. Indeed, when the Airplane reconvened for two albums, Kreisch and Piazza were in the lineup. There was no shortage of white boys playing old-time blues in the 60s. Hot Tuna was something else, however. Kaukonen's principal influence was Reverend Gary Davis, who had a distinctive ragtime technique. Kaukonen upped the dynamics of Davis's style with an explosive, almost violent finger-picking style of his own. Cassidy, one of the best bass players of the time, brought a swing to the rhythm section and a rare melodic invention. In short, he was funky. Davis's songs tended towards the fire and brimstone, which suited the dark, psychedelic side of Hot Tuna to a T. Unfortunately, Kaukonen was not much of a writer. The best Tuna original, Third Week in Chelsea, was co-opted for an Airplane album. Hot Tuna's albums became increasingly weak the further they got from their roots and from the audience. Their second album, however, recorded live, bursts with dark molten energy. The key song, Keep Your Lamps Trimmed and Burning, sounds nothing like a traditional blues, but it's a gutsy, ominous improvisation. Even the more traditional blues numbers like Candyman jump and rock with a hopped-up energy. Kaukonen and Cassidy were the perfect at riding the tiger. They fed off the audience and each other in splendid combustion, and few LPs had burned so bright. This is Hot Tuna, and Keep Your Lamps Trimmed and Burning. Like I say, it was recorded live.
Father, keep right on. Well, now, don't stop a praying, for this whole world is almost done. Keep your lamp trim and burn. Keep your lamp. Keep your lamp trim and burn. For this world is almost done. Now, sister, don't stop praying, brother. Yeah. pencil work is almost done. Keep her alive. Keep her alive. Keep her alive. Trim and burn her. For the soap work is almost
tuna and keep your lamps trimmed and burning here on Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4. This is 1001 songs and I am Seth Titley Jones. I will be with you for another 35 minutes during which the next song I have for you is The End by the Beatles. Wait, there's a second Beatles track tonight. You got, you know, I've noticed Toby Cresswell here. He got right into Bob Dylan about 100 pages ago. Now he seems to be going through all the Beatles. It's interesting that. I think he just sort of wrote the songs down as they came to him. I'm not sure if they're at all linked in any way. They seem to be a fairly random order to me, but I'm not inside his mind. I'm just reading what he wrote down. The Beatles and The End from 1969. The Beatles assembled Abbey Road as a farewell. Let It Be, the final album, was already recorded at this and at this point discarded. So it's an entirely appropriate note on which to end. Most of the second side of the album was an extended medley of half-formed songs patched together by Paul McCartney that rises up to carry that weight, one of the many songs that Beatles wrote about the trials of being in the Beatles. Then comes Ringo Starr's only recorded drum solo, followed by a farewell guitar solo taken by the other three Beatles in turn. John Lennon said, "There's always a nice little bit I played on Abbey Road. Paul gave us each a piece, a little break." A little break where Paul plays, George plays, and I play, and then it stops on Carry That Weight. Then it suddenly goes boom boom on the drums, and we take it in turns to play. I'm the third one on it. I have a definitive style of playing, always have. I was overshadowed. They call George the invisible singer, but I'm the invisible guitarist. Finally, there's a brief lyric. The love you take is equal to the love you make, which had the approval of Lennon himself. Not a big hit. The end has a delicate, concise sweetness and is a fitting farewell. Lest anyone get too serious, the song is undercut by the twee Her Majesty. The perfect ending to a perfect career. Beatles and The End, here on Waiheke Radio. Rufus Wainwright and Want. I'm a big fan of the Pre-Raphaelites. No, the Pre-Raphaelites. I'm guessing that this is, Raphael is in the Italian artist, a little bit before Michelangelo. Rufus Wainwright once explained, Millet, Edward Burne-Jones, and I realized recently that my music is Pre-Raphaelite in a certain way, that it reinvents an older era and romanticizes it. It puts in this gilded frame. Unlike the Pre-Raphaelites, however, Wainwright looks dead in the face of the modern world on Want. He describes Want 1, sorry, that's the album that Want is off. He describes, with sumptuous orchestrations, a season in gay hell. Wainwright is an instant cult hero on the release of his 1998 eponymous debut. His lineage, the son of Ludon Wainwright III and Kate McGriggle, and friend Lorca Cohen, Sean Lennon, Jenny Muldaur et al., helped, but it was really his strikingly original songwriting that made the album one of the year's best. Wainwright then shot up his celebrity and dived into a binge of anonymous sex and hardcore drugs, culminating in a night on a combination of crystal meth and ecstasy and Special K, and that's ketamine, not the breakfast cereal, and cocaine and God knows what. Wainwright went temporarily blind. Time for rehab. And a new album. Like his father, Rufus writes about himself. At least he didn't put Rufus Wainwright right. That would have been really tongue-twister. His family, and, with a fairly sardonic wit, the times in which he lives. He is not a folk singer like his dad, but rather a more sophisticated in both his lyrics and instrumentation. The phrases theatrical and operatic are bandied about, but it's the plush sound of his piano and the dexterity of his voice that recall the Depression-era writers. His lyrics display an enormous self-absorption, but then it's quite a story to tell. He documents the ambivalence and anger between his absent father and son, his depression, and the traumas of a unique life, including his rape at age 14, and his inability to find love and sex in the same place at the same time. His third album, produced by Marius Devrier, more commonly known as Björk, is seductive and immensely powerful. Wainwright will be one of the most memorable songwriters of the new century. Well, we're now 11 years into that new century. In fact, when he wrote this book, they were 5 years into the new century. But just bear in mind, there's a margin of 6 years here, in whatever he's saying. The Wainwright will be one of the most memorable songwriters of the new century. On the title track, he pulls it all together with a rambling cry, "I don't want, I know, I really don't want to be John Lennon or Leonard Cohen." I can't remember how this bit goes, but I'll just read it out to you. "I just want to be my dad, with a slight sprinkling of my mother, and work at the family store." Well, you'll see how those lines go in a second, because here, for your listening pleasure, is Rufus Wainwright with "Want."
I don't want to make it rain, I just want
I had packed my
security. I realized I had one more bag left. I just wanna know if something's coming for to get me.
Rufus Wainwright and Want, here on 1001 Songs, the great songs of all time, and the artists, the stories, and the secrets behind them, with me, your host, Seth Tetley-Jones, on Waiheke Radio. This station here, which we broadcast on at 88.3 and 107.4, frequency modulation, is... And also live streaming on waihikiradio.org.nz. And here on this show, we have the fun-loving criminals in Love Unlimited. They came to prominence with the novelty hit Scooby Snacks, which mixed pop cravings with dialogue sampled from Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction. However, there's much more to this trio. They are to rap what Martin Scorsese is to gangsters, which is to say somewhere between an affectionate tribute and a parody. The fun-loving criminals inhabit an imaginary Brooklyn of small-time addiction and big-time romance, but there is a great distance between their cartoon gun-toting fantasies and their real life on the streets. But the essential factor here, even greater than the apparent wit of the lyric, is the classic melodies which they have appropriated. Much of the music goes back to the Delta Blues and the Chicago Chess records of Bo Diddley and Chuck Berry. The fun-loving criminals have recontextualized the staples of R&B, filtered it through a Lou Reed blender to get in touch with deadpan poignancy, and then added a pop melody that just won't quit. One of the reasons I like the Stones is because they could play country and western or rock or blues and still be the Stones, said Huey, who writes the songs, sings, and plays the guitar. Their energy transcended style. Bands are now alternative grunge or alternative hip-hop. You can't just be a band. Van Gogh painted the other shit than Starry Night. He painted flowers and all types of shit. He painted himself with an air gun. On this track, they get busy with super strings of Barry White and the deeply sexual moods of Love Unlimited Orchestra reduced to a trio. It's both funny and sexy. The lyric thing? I never really did that before this band. I'm like Tom Waits with a lobotomy, Huey said. Some people say to me, talk to us about rapping. And I'm like, maybe you should talk to somebody else, like a rapper. You know what I'm saying? And this is Fun Loving Criminals and Love Unlimited.
Said it's better doing dress. They're sucking on the pipe. No, when she came over, she brought the discus on and on. She promised to kick this. EWF stole my breath. When he finished, there was nothing left. Fat like JP Getty, we make it happen, ass slapping, sitting on the point to where you never catch us napping. CEO, if you know, he got the money grips, no parking for Saturday night and the pips know the hymns, they singing along like knowing the verbs is gonna keep you from the twilight.
Fun-loving criminals. Oh, that really is a hard word to say. Criminals. Fun-loving criminals. Especially when it appears after loving. Fun-loving criminals and Love Unlimited. Here on Waiheke Radio, 88.3 and 107.4 FM. Crowded house. And don't dream it's over. We didn't know when we finished the first album that Don't Dream It's Over was going to be a big hit at all, Neil Finn admitted. The track, accompanied by a magnificent video by the director Alex Proyas and non-stop touring by Crowded House, eventually topped the US charts and was a cornerstone of their brilliant career. Their medium-tempo, ethereal ballad owed a small debt to the Beatles across the universe and had a similar dreamlike quality. I'm never conscious when I'm writing of any kind of intellectual requirement for the song, said Finn. It's a case of being able to drift off and dream away in the right manner and then falling upon something that seems to bring an emotion out with you. At that point, you try and get as much of that feeling down on paper as you can and resist the urge to go off and make a cup of tea as a reward. Don't Dream It's Over, I wrote on one go on my brother's piano in this house in Melbourne. There were people around visiting at the time, and I shut myself away in a room, and that was the reason I wrote, they come to build a wall between us. Recording the first album in Los Angeles was a difficult process. At one point, producer Mitchell Froom brought in session Supremo's Jerry Schiff and Jim Keltner to replace house members Nick Seymour and Paul Hester. The next day, they recorded Don't Dream It's Over, and the new trio clicked. I think it had a particularly sad groove to it, said Finn. I think it's because Paul and Nick had faced their own mortality. The song brought a new beginning to the group, away from the straight guitar pop and into a more sophisticated territory. Mitchell was very influential on certain things about that first record, and the feel in particular, said Finn. Having come from a pretty white Anglophile pop band with split ends, Mitchell played these very out-of-the-way keyboards that just suspended the chords in a very dreamy and appealing way, and that, again, was different. The song was later covered by Paul Young, and that version kicked off in House's career in Britain, and has the song covered numerous times since. Like most songwriters, Neil Finn remains uncertain why this particular song became a classic, and has certain universalness about it, he offered. There's a hopeful, positive sentiment to it, but I think it's turned into melancholy, and that's the first, and that's real life too. And I think in America, if you put the word freedom in the first line, it really helps. Beyond that, I have no idea. It's just the way the chords and the melody work together. It's always a deep mystery, and it just seems to work. This is Crowded House, and Don't Dream It's Over. Springs to mind. This is Waiheke Radio, and that was Crowded House, and Don't Dream It's Over. This is 1001 Songs as well, and I'm Seth Tetley Jones. And next, is Anika. Anita. Not Anika. Anita Baker. And Caught Up in Rapture from 1986. As the queen of Quiet Storm, Anita Baker's second album drew comparisons with jazz greats Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald, although there was a strong strain of R&B and soul in her tracks, and a strong groove as befits a Detroit girl. Baker had made one acclaimed album, The Songstress, before she signed with Elektra and cut an album that influenced the shape of R&B in the mid-80s. I didn't know I had it in me. See, she said later, I wanted a smooth product with energy and heart, but I surprised myself. There was passion there. I knew I could pop a note, but the nuances, I think, are what's important. Baker executive produced the album, choosing old friend Michael J. Powell as producer for most of it. There, she fought with a difficult legal battle to get out of her previous contract, because she wanted creative freedom and she wasn't going to give it up. Elektra, she said, left me the hell alone. I knew what I wanted to sing, I knew what kind of production I wanted, which was the minimalist approach. As the title suggests, Rapture is an album of sensual joy and spiritual peace. The combination of jazz, gospel, and R&B flavors was unique. It was music for adults as well as the pop charts. The key track is the intense and intimate Caught Up in Rapture. Part of the charm of the record was that it was made without any expectations of major success, and its unadorned romanticism made the grooves that much more sensual. From a virtual unknown, Rapture made Baker an instant superstar, no one being more surprised than the singer herself. Anita Baker and Caught Up in Rapture. Yes, well, do you know what this is? This is an 18-second series of samples from Anita Baker and Caught Up in Rapture, so we'll just ignore that and move on to the next one, shall we? That happens sometimes here at Waiheke Radio, and we apologise. We're doing the best that we can. And the next one is Neil Young and Crazy Horse with Cinnamon Girl. Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere is probably my best, Neil Young said in the early 70s. It's my favourite one. I've always loved Crazy Horse from the first time I heard Rocket's album on White Whale. The original band had 69 and 70. Molina, Talbot, Witten, and me. It was just wonderful. Everything I've ever done with Crazy Horse has been incredible, just for the feeling, if nothing else. Cinnamon Girl opens everybody with its cryptic love song lyrics over the crunching power of Crazy Horse. The music was largely improvised. They said they stuck at rehearsals because they didn't have any attention span. In 1969, Neil Young was still finding his feet, having tasted success with the Buffalo Springfield and failure with his first solo album. All the tracks on this record have the tentative sense of a songwriter struggling to find his muse. The lyrics are feverish, as is the tune, based on an open tuning he learnt with the Byrds that enabled him to attain a reggae-like groove that mirrored the 103 degrees Fahrenheit fever from which he had recently recovered. A single edit and mix was done of the track that started Young's solo career. It's the cinnamon taste of the song, spicy, tart and sweet, that makes the track interesting still. It's the most eloquent rock critic, John Mendelsohn, who put it, in his best work, as in Everybody Knows, wherein Crazy Horse's heavy, sinister accompaniment made unmistakable message, a lot of desperation begetting brutal vindictiveness, which almost impenetrably subjective words hinted only at broadly basic sound, a song further vivified that lyric fragments suggested. And this is not meant to be Anita Baker and Caught Up in Rapture. It is meant to be Neil Young and Cinnamon Girl. Young and Crazy Horse with Cinnamon Girl. That was 1001 songs for another week here on Waiheke Radio 88.3 and 107.4 FM. I, Seth Tetley Jones, shall be back next week, Monday, 8 p.m., and of course, repeated Saturdays at 2 p.m.